From WXXI News, I'm Michelle Faust, and this is Connections. Evan Dawson is out today. Today, our connection goes back more than 30 years. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 1980, 7% of 6 to 11-year-olds in this country were obese. In 2012, that number rose to 18%. The same year, nearly 21% of 12 to 19-year-olds were considered obese. Childhood obesity is linked to lifelong risks of serious diseases, including diabetes, high cholesterol, stroke, high blood pressure, and certain types of cancer. In 2012, more than a third of children and adolescents were obese or overweight. The CDC links the rates of obesity with caloric imbalance. Simply put, kids are eating more than they're exercising. In the studio today, we ask the question, how do we raise healthy kids? And our guests for this hour are pediatrician Stephen Cook from the URMC's Golisano Children's Hospital. Thank you for coming in. And Deborah Ross, founder of Kids Out and About, a website with suggestions for parents. Thank you both for joining us today on Connections.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with Dr. Cook. What is obesity and what are the real risks to children? I started with some stats from the CDC. Those come from 2012. Is there any indication that things are improving or possibly getting worse?
So there's lots of data that's been coming out in February and March of this year. Actually, some national data had suggested that there's some shift in the prevalence of obesity, seen some declines in the youngest children, 2 to 5-year-olds in the U.S. And that was encouraging. Some groups went a little far thinking, you know, we've had some major impact because of recent policy changes, but 2 to 5-year-olds aren't impacted by school-level policies, I think. At the same time, though, we've looked at levels of severe obesity or adolescents with obesity, and those rates are the same, unchanged, in some cases actually getting higher, especially if we look at it from a disparity standpoint. So there is some encouragement, and it's important to get a sense of really what age groups for kids that you're looking at and what are those settings, because like we pointed out, preschool-age children aren't affected by major school type of strategies. That said, we know that all the strategies need to be on the table, so we want to keep that in mind.
Now, I was kind of struck by what you just said about 2 to 5-year-olds. How does a 2 to 5-year-old become obese or have a problem with their weight?
Sure. It's something that people, I think, struggle with a lot. But if we look at how we kind of clinically and population, from a population standpoint, define obesity, it's really it was created from pooled data of children through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and the top 5%. The cutoff for those values for their body mass index was used as the cutoff for obesity. And then as we've continued to collect national data, that same cutoff, now 20 years later, there's 15 or 16% of kids above that cutoff. When you look at like a research tool, a gold standard like a DEXA scan, which gives you body mass, fat mass, bone mass, and you look at how many kids are above a 95th percentile, 99% of those young kids have excess body fat. 30-35% body fat. So, you know, it's something that on a population level gives us a really good indicator. On an individual patient level, it's not as sensitive, but still pretty specific. And what that means is you can have kids who are in what's considered a normal range, but you can't differentiate if they have fat mass or muscle mass. And so it's a delicate area to bridge. And I think an important piece that we like to highlight is it's about the behaviors. It's about lifestyle factors. But it's also the fact that there is a biology behind this. And it's really important to understand that there's also a certain amount of biology and science that just doing prevention doesn't always reverse it.
Now, I looked at a study that came out of the UK. Their rates of obesity are pretty similar with children. And it was linking obesity in childhood with early puberty in both girls and boys, although it's slightly higher with girls. What's the risks associated with that trend with kids having obesity? I mean, excuse me, hitting puberty early, and why is that related to obesity?
You know, it's one of these really interesting findings. We see it in the U.S. as well, and it's difficult to totally tease it out. Some of the actually animal models will suggest this, and population studies suggest that part of it is the excess calories. The body starts maturing faster, so it enters into puberty and growth faster because of that. The implications down the road, we worry, is that it actually, because these hormones are changing for puberty, it starts your metabolic clock, in a sense, ticking a little earlier. So if you really have a child who's going into precocious puberty very early, we know they are at higher risk for hypertension and high cholesterol. So one of our concerns is kids entering puberty earlier related to obesity is that. But I think also from a very social emotional standpoint, kids who are obese tend to be taller. And if they're entering puberty earlier, they look older. But socially, they're usually more immature. And so the expectations placed on them by adults and teachers really are inappropriate at times and not developmentally appropriate for the kids. So it's a very difficult time alone going through puberty regardless. And then when people are expecting more of you, it's even more of a challenge.
Now, I imagine, Deborah Ross, this as a mother and someone who advises parents, that must be a bit shocking. Like, what do you tell parents about this?
Right. Well, you know, I think that, as Dr. Cook will tell you, it all starts with a parent's attitude when they're raising kids. So I'm raising girls who have just entered teenagerhood. When they became preteens, I realized that I needed to start being an inspiration to them to model healthy body image. I didn't want them fixating on this. This is a particular problem for girls in our society. And I wanted them to be active. It's likely that they will have jobs with their minds rather than their bodies. And so I knew that if they're going to be spending their lives sort of behind a desk or their professional lives, they needed to have a model who was showing them that activity, both mental and physical, is a daily part of your life that makes you happy. So that's the way I think that parents can inspire kids, by adopting a sort of a whole family attitude toward health being a great thing, activity being a great thing that we do together that helps us connect. Then kids will be happy doing that as kids, and they'll grow into adults who have those as their, you know, what they fall back on as normal.
Yeah, and you're talking about activity, but we have to think about food and in the caloric intake. What are we eating? And, you know, we can get something that has the same amount of calories, but what is the nutrition? And what do you, as a pediatrician, Dr. Cook, what do you tell parents and patients in your practice?
It's becoming increasingly difficult to try to actually even counsel because, you know, the origins around a lot of nutrition standards started, you know, really actually with World War II, because draftees and men enrolling in the Army were excluded because of nutritional deficiencies like vitamin D deficiency or rickets or scurvy, which is vitamin C deficiency. And so we've tried to boost the food production in the country and the quality of food. But with that, you know, market forces taking over start creating processed foods, a lot more processed foods. And we've come to a society where our defaults are a lot of processed packaged foods, as opposed to foods that are grown out of the ground, meals that are prepared at home, maybe planning meals for the week. So trying to get families to understand that is really difficult because a perception is if it's on television, it's on a box, it's true, that it's healthy, that it's low-cal, that it's low-fat.
And that came out just about there was some controversy over these fortified cereals that had the vitamin intake was way too much for young people. What is the risk there?
Well, you know, I think that's an interesting case. It's probably one of the more extreme cases that probably isn't as helpful because it adds more confusion. So if you had kids who have pretty narrow eating patterns and they eat fortified, you know, a fortified, iron fortified or vitamin fortified cereal, and that's all they eat, then yes, they're going to probably get higher levels. But I'm sure they're just as likely to be deficient in other nutrients, proteins, things like that. So it's really difficult to find that balance. And for families trying to offer healthy options and figuring out what those are, they're really shocked when they get a sense of, all right, these packages and processed foods, they seem okay, but they're probably not. And we have to worry about it because on the other end, too much processed foods as well as, you know, you're getting excess sugar in those. People are thinking, well, it's low fat, you know, but it's replaced by sugar. If the sugar is replaced with sodium, and so you're getting too much sodium. And a lot of these things are silent. They don't give symptoms. They don't hurt, make you feel uncomfortable. But when I've had people who eat a lot of processed foods say, you know, we actually started just cooking more meals, getting away from processed foods, and we went to McDonald's, like, you know, after a month or two of not going, it was kind of disgusting. I couldn't finish the hamburger. It was too fatty and greasy and stuff. So it's very difficult, and the food industry is tough because their obligation is to make money selling food.
Now, Deborah Ross, when parents are trying to feed their kids better, sometimes, you know, if you're a working mother and you've got to take your kid all around to their different sports and their different activities, how do you make that happen? How do you have healthy foods instead of just going through the drive-thru, which is easier?
Right. Well, I think that a lot of parenting comes down – successful parenting comes down to introducing your kids to a variety. So to a variety of experiences, to a variety of food. I mean, food is a joyful thing. It can be a really joyful thing. And focusing on sort of the end result of you want your kids to have a wide variety, if you have that always in mind, what's the end goal? Then when you're going to the grocery store, you can think a variety of colors, a variety of nutrients, a variety of different tastes and textures, and involve your kids in the deliberate planning for variety. And I think that helps bring sort of, you know, connectedness as you're cooking together and sort of the joy back into parenting.
I think that's really, you know, good advice to talk about variety. And I think that's good advice, especially for an adult who wants to eat more healthy and is trying to make better decisions. But when you're a kid, sometimes I'm thinking about a family that I knew. They were all vegan and they ate just wonderful food and they'd invite me over and it was great. But their kids only wanted to eat chicken nuggets, and that was every day, and they didn't want a variety, and they didn't really push that. I don't know, you know, what would you tell one of those parents?
Right. It's a hard balance. I had the same exact issue with my kids. You know, part of this is the gradual introduction of variety. Kids are going to go through periods where they want one thing. They want to read one type of book. They want to do one type of activity. They want to eat one type of food. I did a lot of reading when my kids were in that toddler preschool age to say, okay, do I see an end in sight? How do I ride this through? And a lot of the advice basically boils down to keep offering, keep offering. You as parent, be made happy by the peppers, the nice raw peppers, or whatever you happen to be eating and cooking. Involve them in cooking, because some of it's going to make its way in, even if that's not exactly what they want right at that moment.
Dr. Cook, would you give the same advice?
It's really important for parents to understand that, especially, you know, going from infants, toddlers, and then beyond toddlerhood, we know that kids naturally experience a certain amount of narrowness in their opinions or perspectives, so whether it's food or what they want to watch or clothes or things like that. So to expect that, and trying to do a division of labor with the family and getting the family to understand, especially if, you know, mom or dad are really anxious about it, that it's your job to decide when you're eating and what is being served. It's their job to decide if and how much. And you got to be okay with that. And that's a really hard part. And just put it on the plate. Don't worry about whether they eat or not. Not getting into a food fight, though that's hard. Families really get emotional at times and be like, just try it, just try it. That's a huge struggle. But also, overpraising can be just as much of a struggle, because they may have tried it out of their own curiosity, but then they're feeling this kind of added pressure to it, and, you know, maybe they didn't like it. And we know that when new foods are introduced, especially in toddlers and infants, it's probably 15 tries before they really kind of come to something. Whereas, you know, the second spoonful of squashed peas and a child naturally sticks out their tongue because they're only 6 months old and it's more of a reflex than anything. And the parent thinks, oh, they don't like peas. They hate peas. I'm not going to give peas. So now you're stuck thinking you never can eat that food. The other thing I always ask parents about too is, because, again, there's a biology to this, there are genetic preferences to food textures, food colors, smells. And if I ask a mom, like, oh, she never eats her broccoli or green vegetables or whatever, I'm like, how are you with, you know, broccoli and green vegetables, mom? Oh, can't stand it. So it's really important to understand that, because that exists. And so having it on the plate, they choose to eat it or not, that's fine. Try to have an option there that they want to eat, and just be kind of specific about, you know, this is what we're having, this is what we're eating. If you don't want to eat it, that's fine, but that's what we have now.
So you don't think that parents should have the clean plate club where they finish everything on the plate?
No. Yeah, I mean, that's actually one of these areas that, you know, the concept of that, and I grew up with a lot of Italian relatives of, you know, you finish your plate. So I was exposed to it. But that was also at a time when food wasn't as readily available. Portions weren't as big. The plates, the cups, everything weren't as big. The amount of processed foods weren't as available. So you had a meal, but the reality was that you probably hadn't had it, you know, clean your plate at dinner, but you didn't have anything since noon for lunch. You didn't have an after-school snack, and you didn't have something right before you ate. So the kind of old-school mentality of that really kind of culturally doesn't fit as well with our society. And there's actually been some studies showing kids in the Clean the Plate Club anecdotally consume higher amounts of calories, had higher rates of obesity. If you identify kids and families who are ascribing to that kind of mantra, clean your plate.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about exercise. You had mentioned that you like to model good forms of exercise. You have your website, Kids Out and About.
Right.
What kind of examples and ideas do you give to parents as far as things that they can do to get their kids more physically active?
Sure. Again, variety is the key, right? So that especially young kids, they haven't necessarily picked the sport that consumes them or, you know, the particular kinds of activity. And so introducing them to activities that might not necessarily be your favorite is something that a lot of parents just don't think of right off the bat. But what we do at kidsoutandabout.com is we put all of these things right in front of them, right? We give them lists. We give them, you know, calendars of activities, and it gives them ideas that just would not have been on their radar otherwise. So I did that with my kids. I was not into martial arts. It wasn't something that I grew up with. But I thought, hey, they should try that. And so they did, and one of them is now a black belt. I'm not particularly a soccer fan. I don't like to watch soccer. It's just not my thing. But we tried soccer. Just because it didn't, you know, hit me the right way when I was a kid doesn't mean that it won't hit them. Neither of mine is into soccer, right, as it happens. But they had that shot. There's lots of free ways to do this, too. We can accomplish this without spending any money. There are playgrounds throughout the greater Rochester area. There are hiking trails throughout the greater Rochester area. You can go roller skating on the canal. You can go biking on the canal. There's, you know, you do not actually have to spend money to have a variety of things that you do out and about. So if you as a parent, even if you don't feel inspired that day to do that, masking your laziness, putting on that face, and going and having fun with your kids, you will not regret it. It's just hard sometimes to overcome the inertia and the temptation to sit and look at your phone or put your kids in front of a screen.
Yeah. Dr. Crook, there have been a few studies recently that have suggested that when you have your kids doing one sport and you really want your kid to be that football superstar and you have him in football camp from very young and they don't switch up sports, that it can lead to injury. And I actually spoke last night with a friend of mine who is a physical therapist who said you're seeing more and more high-level injuries to very young kids. What's the danger of that?
The danger is exactly that they hyper-focus on sports and a single sport, so they get really good at that. They get the muscle memory for that, but then other muscle systems don't really respond the same way. You know, being a point guard and bringing a quarterback and being a pitcher on a baseball team require different skill sets, different muscle sets. Overall strength, stamina, and coordination are important, but when you focus on just the one, especially growing bodies, you're going to be more susceptible to wear and tear injuries. And it's really scary because we don't know what those mean. You know, I remember as a kid, the concept that Tommy John had this special surgery on his elbow and they weren't sure if it would really work, the way they had to repair the elbow tendons. I mean, now it's a procedure that gets done on high school kids. Tommy John surgery is what it's called. And we never saw that because kids are hyper-focusing on sports. And as opposed to 3 or 4 months a year, they're doing 8 or 9 months a year of it. And the sad part is, without having some variety of activities, whether it's just organized sports or other leisure activities, they burn out from that sport. Because the reality of them going on to being a high-level athlete, even a college-level athlete in a sport, is pretty low. But getting them also into active daily behaviors, whether it's walking or biking or riding or, you know, spending time outside is going to be far more helpful in the long run. And so you have the physical damage that can occur, and then you have a kid who gets totally turned off to sports. And, you know, once they lose that, that actually is somewhat of a loss of their social identity too. And you have to they struggle with, you know, kind of who they are at a later period in life.
For clarity, you're not saying not to expose them to sports, but to have them in a variety of sports, not just in one hyper-focus of a sport.
Yes, I exactly that. You need to look at a variety of sports. I have concern of families that do, at very young age, start hyper-focusing on sports because it's just as much about the parents as the kids. And that's where a lot of behaviors really have to get into, what the family really thinks and believes and looks at. It's great to offer a variety of sports, but if you have a dad who also just regularly jogs, you know, and the kids don't want to do sports, but if they're going to jog with dad, you know, that's a great role model. And we actually know there's studies that show that girls follow physical activity behaviors of their fathers. And so that's a really simple thing of asking families, you know, don't have to join a gym or, you know, do Pilates or specific types of exercise as much as just doing something regularly, going on regular walks, biking, going to the playground. You know, being active and engaged and being outside is a huge connection. And then if there's also a kind of an activity pattern with it as well, there's a greater likelihood that gets modeled to your children.
Now, if you have a child that is obese and you want your child to lose weight, how do you address that in a way that, first of all, gets them to a healthy body mass, but doesn't give them a complex, that doesn't make that child start to, you know, develop low self-esteem or have other problems that are associated with obese childhood?
Well, it's a really, really difficult conversation because it's, again, in pediatrics and dealing with kids, everything is very age and stage specific. So even though a child may be obese or in an obese range, if they're 2 or 3 or 4, they don't have to lose weight. Just growing and even slowing down their rate of weight gain. You know, in the previous year, they gained 10 pounds over the year. Now, if they gain 5 pounds, with their height adjusting, their weight to height ratio or their body mass index is going to improve. So it's really important to, as pediatricians, to try to understand that to make sure we're not giving a message of weight loss. Second of all, it's really a message about, you know, are there behaviors that can be changed? Because it can be as simple as, you know, cutting out the liquid calories from a kid's diet. Parents are reporting juice and soda. It's like, you know what, make sure they get 2 glasses of milk a day or so, keep the rest water, don't do anything else different. You know, maybe get the TV out of the bedroom. That's another issue. But, you know, small changes, not join a gym, go on a vegan diet, try a 10-day detox or any of those things. And when you get those questions, to me, that drives me nuts because that's society dictating something where there's no evidence or science. But we have to understand that obesity is a disease. At some point, excess body weight, excess body fat is a disease. And it's really important to understand that it's not a personal choice. And there's more and more science showing that there's a biology that drives this. When you put on excess body fat, your body fights to defend that weight and keep it. And so when you try to lose, it's even harder because of metabolic compensation your body goes through. And I make that point because obesity is the most common chronic disease we see, and it is the most stigmatized disease. Still is a highly stigmatized disease in this country. So prevention and some of these things on a community level are really important, but we have to understand at the point where there is a disease of obesity, that really does need to be treated as a disease and have specific treatment strategies, but also hopefully in an environment that is promoting physical activity and is not over promoting excess calories too.
Yeah. As a parent, Deborah Ross, what do you do? I mean, you said you're concerned about your daughter's developing body image issues.
Right. And so here's the other, you know, dirty little secret. I don't like to exercise. However, there's a lot of things that I don't like to do that I don't show that I don't like to do. You fake it until you make it. And so I can take joy in the fact of inspiring my kids to go and be active with me at the gym, in our case, because it makes it easy and sort of defined. That works for our family. Where they don't see my internal monologue going, don't really like this. I really don't like what I'm doing here. Okay, what they see is somebody who overall is taking an immense amount of satisfaction in doing the right thing, and I'm letting that override my, you know, this immediate sense of, oh, can I just get back to work now, you know? And so I think that's actually really important in parenting. There's an element of that fake it until you make it, do the right thing, because you really are interested in doing the right thing and modeling the proper behaviors for your kids. So that's my best advice, my secret advice.
So we're going to take a break in just a moment, and we're going to come back to this conversation talking about raising healthy children, and we'll be looking at some of the ways to develop their minds as well and other things like that. We're talking about raising healthy children right here on Connections. I'm Michelle Faust, today in for Evan Dawson. When we come back, we'll join 2 local librarians who will add to the discussion about developing healthy minds in children. If you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 844-295-8255, 844-295-TALK. We'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to member-supported public radio, AM 1370, FM 91.5, HD2 in Rochester, or FM 89.5 in the Finger Lakes. Coming up in our second hour of Connections, we'll look at plans for the 45th Annual Puerto Rican Festival and the 10th Annual Puerto Rican Parade, both taking place this weekend in Rochester. What's the history of these festivities? And we'll take a serious look at media representation of Latinos. It's all coming up in our second hour on Connections.
Harvard Business School is launching a new program online about which a question. Can they reach more students without diluting the brand?
Our approach is really designed explicitly to strengthen the brand by illustrating through these offerings what the quality of a Harvard Business School education is.
All right, if they say so. I'm Kai Ryssdal, online education and the Ivy League identity, next time on Marketplace from APN.
This evening at 6:30.
We're talking about raising healthy children right here on Connections. I'm Michelle Faust, hosting today in Evan Dawson's stead. My guests this hour are pediatrician Stephen Cook from URMC's Golisano Children's Hospital and Deborah Ross, founder of Kids Out and About. We've been speaking for the first half hour. Joining us now are Adrian Furness of the Henrietta Public Library and Tanya Burton from the Children's Services. She's a Children's Services consultant from the Central Library of Rochester and Monroe County. Welcome, all of you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
In the last half hour of the show, we talked about healthy eating, exercise, and physical health. Now we're going to talk about children's mental health. The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends limited screen time and screen-free zones in homes with infants. The AAP says children learn best from people and not screens, and they show a correlation between too much exposure to television and video games with attention problems, school difficulties, sleep and eating disorders, and obesity. More than 68% of children under the age of 2 get an average of 2 hours of screen time per day, or 15 hours a week. Dr. Cook, what's wrong with allowing our kids to watch TV and play video games?
Well, as we're seeing, there's a number of behaviors, not just the topic today around obesity. It's the mental health issues. It's the sedentary behavior. One of the hidden secrets around television is actually that not so much that you're not active when you're watching TV, it's there's a lot of mindless eating that goes on. Very interesting study out of Buffalo showed that people on average were getting 200, 250 calories extra a day that wasn't accounted for, that they didn't even notice they were eating, related to their screen time. So we worry about that. On top of it, we know that it's not really communication. You think it is, but reading and talking with someone is a very important form of communication, is really what communication is. And parents often think, well, if the TV's on, it's helpful. And a recent study showed that not only is it not helpful, the only kind of background television noise that might be helpful actually is PBS. Sorry if that's a shameless plug. But
that's great. WXXI television.
It's educational television in the background that can be helpful. And so if television is on, sitting down with the kids, realizing what it is they're watching. If there's a video game they're playing, watch what it is they're playing. The implications for video games being that there's lots of violence, there's lots of inappropriate behavior there that kids get conditioned to. They don't realize that cartoon violence, video game violence is not real. And so there's a certain amount of acceptance of this is violent behavior and this is actually acceptable. So there's lots of concerns we have with it. And if you ask the food industry, they say, and they have cut down the amount of media advertising dollars they're spending because they're not spending as much on television, the most expensive component, but they're doing far more media outreach via the internet and the web and video games and placing products and items in those settings. So they're actually getting more media exposure for less dollars.
So before we came on the air, we talked a little bit about that books can play a healthy role in eating, and that kind of surprised me. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. There's a curriculum that we actually used with some investigators in Chicago. It's called Hip Hop to Health Junior, and it was actually developed by a child psychologist who had a background in physical activity, and her other partner was a nutritional epidemiologist. And they created this curriculum for 3-, 4-, 5-year-olds to use in daycare. And actually, it was set up in a way that you didn't need to be a dietitian or a teacher. You just, if you were a man who could manage a group of kindergartners, man, this was perfect for you. And they actually had about 6 or 7 books within that curriculum. Some was food displays, but other things were just activities. So they had Berenstain Bears Too Much TV, and they had Berenstain Bears Too Much Junk Food, and they had The Very Hungry Caterpillar, and they had a variety of well-established kid books that they had as part of it that actually, not that it necessarily taught the kids how to eat healthy, but it portrayed that image repeatedly. And within their curriculum and additional training, it actually was a fun way to make healthy eating part of what kids were seeing and experiencing at a very early age.
I want to turn now, since we're talking about books, to our librarians. Tanya Burton, tell me what kind of books you would recommend to a parent who wants their kid to start eating healthily. I imagine that there must be books of all ages for all different age groups?
There are, right from infants on up. We have board books that will show healthy foods, books that show farms where the foods are produced. Then we can go into books that talk about farmers and how they make the food. And then we have cookbooks that we can give, like Deborah Ross talked about, cooking with your children. There are so many things that you can do with cooking. It ties in science. It ties in math. It ties in just building a relationship with your child and healthy eating. So we have books that can just tie in so many different things with food and the creation of food. And then just even fun stories like the Very, Very Hungry Caterpillar. And then what we do at the library is we help parents have conversations about those books. So The Very Hungry Caterpillar, I think everybody has read that book. And if you haven't, go to the library and check it out. But, you know, so The Very Hungry Caterpillar, you know, he starts with eating different kinds of foods. And so in a story time, we would model to parents, you know, would you eat a sausage and a cupcake and a lollipop? And how would you feel? And having conversations around that.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Adrian Furness, can you tell me like how you would have that conversation with a parent and you're looking at books and having that conversation about exercise and diet?
Well, you know, I think like Deb says, you know, it's variety and taking a variety of approaches and having a good sense of humor, arguing it just never works. You know, the cookbooks are something I really always recommend. Cooking with kids is maddening because they make a huge mess. I like to cook with my godsons, and it just hoses down the place when we're done. But it has helped them to see some different foods, try some different foods, and it's a way, too, for a kid who's maybe not a reader to, you know, have a good experience with a book, too. So that's something we're always thinking about.
I think that's interesting that you mentioned, you know, using books with kids who aren't reading yet. What kind of books? Are you thinking picture books or reading to them? Tell me a little more of that.
Oh, all kinds of things. You know, it's anytime you get a book out with a kid, even a tiny little kid, they're seeing you touch a book, use a book, like a book. So that's part of the really pre-reading skills of, you know, the pages get turned, how you use the book, that there's an index, that there's a table of contents. Kids will get a surprising amount out of just seeing you use a book. It's that modeling that is really important. And certainly picture books, reading out loud to kids, audiobooks. There's so many ways to even with very tiny kids expose them.
Thank you. I'm going to turn to the phones right now. We have a call right now from Sue in Fairport. Hello, Sue, are you on there?
Yes.
You're on the air with Connections.
Yes, thank you. I'm quite surprised to hear that the schools have put in soda machines and snack machines, which makes these sugars, I mean, so easily available, and then cutting out gym. Which I don't understand. I guess I don't understand the motivation for putting in the machines, and certainly not cutting out the activity of gym, which would also give you a variety of sports and the activity, obviously.
Thank
and
you.
How much does that contribute to the obesity, which I was always told that sodas are empty calories?
Thank you very much, Sue. So, Dr. Cook, you had mentioned that there's some policy issues also involved and the policy of allowing or not allowing vending machines in schools.
Thank you for the question, and you're right. All these things play into the equation. There's not one or two or three policies that will really help reverse obesity in this country, but we look at schools and kids get lots of meals at schools. So however it was, the soda industry infiltrated school systems and offered you know, what started as simple contracts for vending machines, and first they were open limited hours and then expanding it and giving schools, you know, dollars for that. When you look at large data nowadays, there's not a lot of like huge revenue coming from these, but they're signed contracts. The other problem is that their marketing infiltration is there. So they'll say, oh, well, we'll have less Coke there. We'll put more water. Well, it's their water product, but they'll still donate, you know, uniforms or put their banner on the side of the school bus or having it at the sports field and stuff. So the marketing infiltration is there. The balance that has come from an education system that's driving test scores and really isn't looking at the whole child developing is causing education systems to respond in the only way they can, which seems to drive more sit-down educational time. And so things that don't do that, like gym or arts or crafts or other ancillary types of programs, get cut. So it's very frustrating to see the effect there. One of the more startling things I think people may not be aware of is that when government spending was cut back in the 80s across the board, departments of education made huge cuts to schools. Well, one thing that did is it got schools away from having actual kitchens, and it went to automated kitchen services that you just had to heat and serve food. So that hugely pushed processed foods into school cafeterias. And so that's one of those things where why do we have that? Well, it was a big change from above years ago that has now driven a system, and the economy responded and said, okay, well, we can provide this product. Unfortunately, really not healthy products.
Yeah, it's interesting that you touched on the funding piece, because we'll be talking about that tomorrow on Connection, so I hope everyone will tune in then. Right now on the line, we've got Bernard in Fairport. Hello, Bernard. You're on Connections.
Yeah, I think I want to expand a little bit on what Sue just said. It seems to me you folks have some very good ideas. They're very constructive, and I'm assuming that there's evidence that they're beneficial. But I think the overriding issue is our social pressures. I mean, it's very easy to talk about feeding the kids the right meals, and certainly when we had kids, that's what we did as grandparents. We're amazed at the pressure that's put on our kids to basically control their lives. So it's very easy to talk about configuring a dinner that's healthy and taking a child to a hospital or, to a library and so on and so forth. But it seems to me that our current economic pressure is that people aren't working 8 hours a day anymore. They're working 24 hours a day. And lower income folks, they're working multiple jobs, and they don't even have a weekly schedule. They have to call in every day to find out what their working schedule is going to be. So it seems to me that certainly the techniques that you're talking about, the approach that you're talking about, has a major problem with the fact that business and government and whoever else doesn't seem to want to contribute to this. They seem to want to take people's personal control of their lives away from them, and they're making them unhealthy. I appreciate your comments on that. And again, thank you very much for your work.
Thank you, Bernard. Now, Deborah Ross, I know you wanted to comment on that.
Sure. I mean, as a parent, I can't comment on policy issues, right? All that an individual, especially a parent, can do is react to what's going on in our society. And the most important thing that I think you can do is use that to have conversations with your kids. I feel, honestly, that I've been pretty successful in looking around at, like, logos at the baseball field, right? And saying to the kids, so you see, Coke all around, right? You see Coca-Cola, you see all that logos. Does that make you want to drink more Coca-Cola? And if they think about it for a minute, the thing, of course, that they say is no, because they don't want to be somebody who drinks more Coke because this marketing message is pushed at them. Well, that's actually, I found, pretty effective at orienting themselves to be very aware of what's going on around them, which is, of course, what we want as parents. And so that's pretty, talk about everything. As a parent, notice everything you can, read everything you can, and use that with your kids to help, be that stepping stone to them being aware and making very deliberate choices for themselves, despite social pressures, despite lots of marketing messages. I found that pretty effective.
I want to jump back to our conversation about screen time. And, there's a lot of time that kids spend in front of a television playing video games. You can take them to the library. What kind of advice do you give parents? I'm gonna start with Adrian Furness from the Henrietta Public Library. What kind of advice do you give parents about, kind of pushing them away from the screens and maybe towards other things? Libraries don't just have books these days.
No, yeah, we, of course, we have the stuff that goes on the screens, too. But when I talk to parents about this, when you get into that screen time argument, which I've heard so many parents have, it's unpleasant for everybody. Everybody hates it. You kind of have to offer things that are more attractive than the screen. And this is where a library can be really helpful. You bring them in once a week. You can get a variety of things. And, sometimes parents will get kind of hung up on, well, don't take all those. You can't read them all. You can't use them all. No, let them take them. Then they've got choices. If you've only got one book to read and you hate the one book, you aren't going to read the book. So You know, and we have other things too, programs going on certainly that are active. You know, this afternoon our children's librarian Ann Hicks is doing a Makey Makey program, which is actually this thing is like magic. You can use it to make anything into a computer input. So she'll have the kids working with that and trying to figure out, you know, what could we use as an input and what could it make the computer do. So that kind of taps into that love of the screen, but turns it into an active kind of thing. So where they're thinking and doing and making. So I think that's another way to do it, you know, flip that passive activity into something active.
Thank you. So Tanya Burton, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I just so in a lot of the city libraries, it's a very different culture. And a lot of the food choices, you know, we hear about that. You know, you have a parent who is working two or three jobs, and providing healthy choices is expensive. You know, it's definitely prohibitive for a lot of the families that we see at our libraries. So we do partner with places like Food Link to try to provide those healthy choices. In the libraries, we have really, as the librarians talked about the choices that we provide people, you know, it's kind of, you know, if you feed them, they will come. And so for some of our programs, you know, we do offer food. So we try to make healthier choices for the foods that we provide. And then we talk to the kids about why we have apples and not cookies. You know, why do we serve water and not that like bright green high C or whatever it is that they drink. And so that's one of the ways that we try to interact and help families and children make healthy food choices. A lot of the times we don't see the whole family in the library at once. So we'll get, you know, kids who come in and they hang out all day, and the library is their place to be. It's their comfort place. It's their safe place. So we provide different programs. Like Adrian mentioned, you know, all of the libraries have a variety of programs, from Makey Makey to Lego clubs. We have, you know, animals that come in and, you know, kids can learn about hedgehogs. We have Larry Moss coming to do simple machine programs at all the libraries. And of course, you can find them all on DEP's website, kidsoutandabout.com. Mm-hmm. But so we just try to provide as much variety to kids as we can. And yeah, we do provide screen time, but we do try to have conversations with the kids. You know, they have a limited time and, oh, can I get more time? Well, what are you going to do with that? What are you doing? You know, how about we, you know, why don't we read this book together? Why don't we do this activity together? What else can we do? And trying to, you know, tap into some of their interests and what are they doing? At the Central Library, you know, we now have a digital learning lab that we've just opened. It's called Imagine You. And this is for teens. And we're trying to get them away from Facebook and away from the computer and finding out, oh, you like to play video games? Why don't you make your own video game? How do I do that? Let's figure it out. And more active learning. Libraries are really not, like you said, not just about books, not just about screen time. And we're not passive. We're engaged and we're active.
Yeah. Dr. Cook, one thing that comes to me when I hear about screen time and limiting screen time for kids, when I think about if the kids aren't used to using a computer and they don't get, you know, if you had a Steve Jobs who never used a computer, or, you know, Bill Gates that never used a computer, they wouldn't be who they were. But then you've got to limit that so they get out and they do things outside and do exercise and then not have the other problems from being in front of a screen. How do you make that balance?
That's an extremely important question and thought, and it's something that we're not really thinking about. I mean, technology is wonderful, and we're assuming that it's always good for us. Well, the reality is that when a child reads a book and flips the pages and looks at the letters and words, even if they're not really reading, the way their brain is stimulated is different than if they're looking at a tablet and drawing their finger across. It's a different interaction, and there's some data that has shown that the brain actually responds differently. So we have to understand that active learning is going to be a very important thing. We understand technology is important. They are such plastic brains that they learn things very quickly. So exposing them to some media is probably at least useful in the sense of they understand how a computer works and can use it and, you know, go find information from it. It being a sole source of entertainment and their time sink, that's a whole different thing. Because the reality is that you have kids who have less balance and coordination because they're not just outside climbing, playing, jumping, running around. They don't get core strength. I mean, who talks about core strength in a toddler? But you know what? We're seeing kids who are kind of uncoordinated, and yeah, they may be obese, but even if they're not obese, they're just less active. And so we think technology and all these devices we have are helpful and they're good for a lot of things, but no one's thinking that potentially there are side effects, harmful side effects of these. And we have to think of that with children because they are such a vulnerable growth period in their brain and their bodies that we can't just assume that, oh, if it's okay for an adult, it's okay for a kid.
Yeah. I'm going to take another call. We've got Dave in Rochester. You're on Connections.
Hi. It's Dave Topa from Pittsburgh Pediatrics. How are you?
Dr. Topa, thanks for calling.
Hey, no problem. Just calling to address three things, and I'd like to see maybe see if you expound upon them. One is exercise. Rochester's got a great source of trails, networks, the rails to trails. This morning I even took my children down to the lower Meadowfalls on the Genesee. And over the course of about 30 minutes, we were able to cover see two great waterfalls, see small settlements. Really great thing to do with your kids. So it's not like you even have to get them out running or biking or things like that, even just a simple hike. Number two, I'm seeing more and more pouches, like the pouch foods being used amongst kids older than age one. And I don't know what your response would be to this, but I generally do tell parents that you're basically infantilizing a child's chewing behaviors. And, this whole idea of, okay, it's making it convenient. And I think it's, maybe sending a bad message to families as well. And then number three, I feel
I'm gonna ask you
hung
just
up on things that are marketed as being all natural, but yet they don't still realize that even all natural doesn't mean that it's good for you. So even kids coming in at 9 o'clock in the morning munching pirate booty because it says it's organic and all natural on the packaging, but yet it's still overall pretty devoid of any other nutrients.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dave. When you're talking about those pouches, I'm assuming you're talking about like it's applesauce or something, and you just suck on it. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, those pureed, whether it's fruits, vegetables, definitely being sold as an organic, all-natural source of fruit or vegetable for your child. But I'm always a fan of telling parents to have their kids chew their foods as opposed to suck and swallow them. And the same thing, I get lots of questions about smoothies and energy shakes.
Thank you very much.
Dave, thanks for calling in. And it's great to have someone on the front lines who's also weighing in on these same behaviors, and appreciate your work. You're absolutely right. It doesn't have to be organized exercise. We're used to being outdoors in upstate. We snowshoe. We go outside and play in the snow. We can hike, walk around, bike. There's lots of trails in the summer and the winter. So there's no reason to try to think of something very specific. Yes, there's specific places and opportunities to go and be active, but there's just being outside is a huge activity level. So you're right. Simple steps can be helpful. I'm very worried of how food is presented to parents. Parents are worried enough about everything in this world, and we're creating too much worry for parents. And if somehow they think that they're not feeding their child right or healthy, then they have to compensate. So they think organic is healthier. And the reality is if you eat a ton of organic cookies, you're still eating too many cookies.
Right.
So pouch foods, these smoothies, these drinks, too many sippy cups, things like that, they do. They have an effect on a kid's natural ability to eat and to be curious. I mean, they learn by putting all kinds of stuff in their mouth. Yes, you got to be careful that they don't put the wrong thing in there. That's part of our job as parents. So parents are struggling with all these messages, and it comes back to your last point, the third point of marketing. It's, there's too much freedom around the idea of what is marketing healthy and front of the label packaging. If you ask food industry or different industries, they don't want to be restricted. They want to have the freedom to advertise and do whatever. When you really show people what the calories are, what is the composition of these foods, and how much is actually in a serving, it's ridiculous. And so the balance of we have to have our freedom to sell our market, market our foods the way they are. But the reality is they never self-regulate. They never police themselves. And there's actually evidence shows that there's ways to market or at least identify food products. And the food industry, unfortunately, is taking lots of tips from the tobacco industry of how to fight and avoid every one of these steps along the way.
Okay, Deborah Russ, you wanted to add something to that.
I love Dr. Cook's emphasis on the messages that parents are being fed, especially in the last 20 years, 10 years most specifically, the idea that we have to keep our kids safe every moment of every day. And by buying these products or by doing this particular thing, there's a kind of hyper-focus on the moment-to-moment that I think is sort of detrimental. So if we can sort of step back and think sensible, letting kids take some risks, I think that that's, stepping back and teaching them to be independent that way, I think that's one of the solutions.
Okay. Adrian Furness, what kind of books do you have for parents for parenting to learn these skills?
Well, we have a lot of different things. There's a whole section in our library and most libraries, I would say, that's, like games. So it's the 700s. So it's sports books, but then it's also card games and outdoor games and things like that. Lots of ideas. There were a couple books out a few years ago, the Daring Book for Boys, and there was one for girls. And those, it just fun activities, old-fashioned activities. How do you make a paper airplane kind of thing? So I think that can spark some ideas.
Okay, last word, 30 seconds.
Just going to the library and hanging out is so invaluable, connecting with other people and parents and just getting advice. So if I see Deb at the library, hey, my kid's doing this. Did you encounter it? How did you deal with it? And again, like Deb said, using some common sense and just letting kids explore and learn on their own is invaluable.
Okay. We've been talking about raising healthy kids. My guests this hour have been pediatrician Stephen Cook from URMC's Golisano Children's Hospital, Deborah Ross, founder of Kids Out and About, Adrian Furness of the Henrietta Public Library, and Tanya Burton, the Children's Services Consultant for the Central Library of Rochester and Monroe County. Thank you for joining us on Connections. I'm Michelle Faust in today for Evan Dawson. This is WXXI AM Rochester, WXXI FM HD2 Rochester, and WEOS FM Geneva.